Hello and welcome to episode number 18 of Inglourious Artists. Today I'm talking to Melanie Aronson, a documentary filmmaker and cinematographer from the US, who has also lately become an app developer since she created the friend-finding app Panion. We're going to be talking about all this and more. This is my conversation with Melanie Aronson. We're gonna get into everything you've been doing and all that jazz, but we can just start off. You're from the U.S. You're from Massachusetts, right?
Yeah.
And how did you end up in Sweden? What's that journey?
That's a very complicated question. Partly for love, and partly because I've received a Fulbright grant to come do research to work on a documentary film.
Just for research.
Well, no, to make a documentary film, but they take a while.
Yeah, all films take a while. Yeah. But yeah, documentaries, of course, I guess the content dictates the time in some aspects.
Yeah, in documentary, it's about real life, so you have to kind of go with the flow.
Yeah, of course. But what is a Fulbright grant? What does that entail?
It's the U.S. government, I believe it's the Senate, there's like a certain amount of money put aside for cultural exchange. You can go on a Fulbright as a, I might not do this justice, but I will try to explain this. You can go on a Fulbright as like a student or a scholar or, you know, a researcher or someone doing their thesis or something like that, or a professor going to teach a year abroad, or you can go on a Fulbright going to the US from any country, almost any country in the world, to do part of a higher education degree. So it's like exchange in academia, but also now more in the arts as well. So it's trying to like promote American academics and culture abroad and trying to get people to, you know, exchange ideas and collaborate internationally. And for such a progressive idea, it's no wonder that the government, there's been a lot of threats to cut funding for it. So we're hoping it'll stick around because it's a pretty good initiative.
Yeah, sounds great. Is there like an age range for it?
No.
Oh, okay. So you can be basically 65 and get into it. Exactly. All right. It feels like something I want to look into.
Yeah, you should. I mean, I don't know the criteria for going to the U.S., but it's a little more flexible and it's every country in the world except for like our enemy countries.
Oh, the axis of evil.
But yeah, it's a pretty good deal. They basically fund you to live somewhere for a year, fly you there, give you a stipend, you meet some cool people doing other projects. And so for the first year I was in Sweden, I had it real good. I got to just kind of be paid to like do some research and interview people, try to figure out what was going on, you know. And then they said, well, we really care, like what they care about the most is that you're like interacting with your host country. And I'm like, it's a little bit difficult for me to come here and not do that. So I think I'm you know, on a good track here.
Sure, yeah, because you stayed.
Yeah.
You're interacting full on.
Yeah. So
So what was that film that you came here for?
I was making a film about a personal film about living in the West Bank. With my ex-partner and our life there. And then he applied for asylum in Sweden, and I followed the story. And so I wanted to kind of continue like understanding the context of what it was like to apply for asylum in Sweden and the whole landscape, because it was 2014. So it was the influx, the migration influx.
Oh, yeah.
So I really wanted to understand that well for the documentary I was already shooting, and also to maybe do other projects and just trying to really get a grasp of what is it like to integrate, also to integrate here and you know, the whole experience. And simultaneously, I was having my own version of integrating here. Mm. So that was also interesting because I could compare and contrast my experiences to other people's experiences. And I had a lot of struggle, honestly, coming and following all the rules. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of rules in this society, and I've been...
Bureaucracy?
Bureaucratic rules, social rules.
Ah.
And I've...
What kind of social rules do you find to be like weird or challenging?
There's a way to do everything here, and there's, I feel like, not a ton of flexibility if you do it wrong.
Huh. Okay.
So, I mean, the example I think of is like the first few weeks I was here, I was really scared shitless of going to the supermarket because I like had not mastered the system of like when you put down that divider between your food and the other people's food.
Okay.
And I'd get a lot of passive aggressive people would slam it down and angrily look at me because I didn't do it or I did it wrong.
Yeah, I didn't do it for them. Yeah.
And I actually realized that's because in the US we do the opposite.
Okay.
We care about dividing our food from the others because it's like ours and we don't want it to, you know, we're a little bit maybe more selfish. So we always put it down
in front of yours.
Yeah. Mm. And here you do it for the next person.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that and like a lot of things with like entering a door, like the protocol of holding the door for someone or you like actually in Sweden, you walk through the door first. You hold it and then someone walks through. No, wait. Someone walks through, holds it, and then that person goes. So it's like two people holding the door and walking through at the same time.
Huh. Okay.
Whereas we don't do that. If we hold the door, the other person walks through and says thank you.
First, I mean, yeah.
And there's then no, I go in, then I hold it, and then you go in and I keep holding it. And then we go in. We've both held the door at one point in this like transaction interaction. Like that doesn't happen. So I again was like, having these looks of like you're being rude or you're not doing what there were a lot of very subtle social rules that I was breaking.
Okay, a lot of social rules that I guess us natives don't really notice or something. But my first thought is like, are you sure about this? Aren't you being a little sensitive? Because I don't feel like we don't really have any set rules to do things like that at all. Like holding a door. Well, sometimes if I do like your way and hold up the door for somebody to walk through first, then I feel like it's very regal. It's like, here you go, madam. You know, but it happens. But when I do, people are like, oh, okay. They don't think it's weird or something. It's just, huh.
I've held the door for some people here and had very surprised looks. Not angry, but surprised.
Like, is it like that they feel like, you don't think I can open the door myself?
Yeah, I think that's what people think here. But I thought maybe I was being sensitive, but then I started talking to other expats and other immigrants, and we're all on the same page with these little
rules. Okay, they're like, yeah, right.
You know, and I think, there just seems to be like a very specific way to do things, and now I know, so it's not a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of assumed coming from the US to Sweden, it would be kind of the same. Everyone would be more blonde and, you know, it would be a darker winter. And
oh, that's true.
And in another language. And, you know, I didn't think about all I didn't realize like I can't just talk to people in the street while I'm waiting for the bus or on the, you know, on the train. Like all of these kinds of social rules are very different.
And yeah. Well, we don't really do it.
You don't do it.
You don't find it to be kind of welcoming when you actually reach out and do that? Because I think...
I've had people look at me like I'm borderline mental.
Okay. Because the Swedes can be kind of social if you just break the ice, I feel.
Yeah, in some contexts, for sure. But I was like smiling at everyone walking by me on the street or nodding, like things that I was raised to do.
Okay.
People are looking around them like, is there someone you know behind me? Or like, what are you doing? Or just really uncomfortable in their own skin. Like, what do I do back? Or, I mean, also like, you know, I'll say like, hey, how are you? At the beginning of a conversation. And again, it's kind of like, where I'll say like, okay, thank you, have a nice day. Blah, blah, blah. Like I'll end with a lot of things. And people will be like, Yeah, you too. Like, they won't know how to respond because you don't really do it as much.
No, not as much. No, absolutely.
There's only these little subtle things, but it's just different. I mean, it just takes getting used to. And when you, no one teaches you and you have to learn from, you know, error, trial and error. Mm,
sure.
It's uncomfortable at the beginning, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. But where do you get that thing to, about nodding to people, smiling to people on the street?
We do that.
But haven't you, like, lived in...
New York? We do that in New York.
But you meet 100 people a minute on the street in New York.
No, but it's different. Yeah, okay, if you're in a crowd, no. But if you and another person are passing and there's no one else on the street, you acknowledge each other.
Really? In New York?
Yeah, you're sharing a space. You acknowledge each other.
Isn't New York, like, full of crazy people? Don't you open up for potentially weird situations all the time then?
But someone's not going to stab you because you, like, looked them in the eye.
Hopefully not, no.
No. And you kind of have a gauge of how to read who you you should engage with and who you shouldn't.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Mm.
I like that, though. I mean, the whole being like, hey, how you doing?
Yeah. I mean, in nice New York, day. We think it's crazy because in, like, the, in other parts of the country that are considered friendlier, people will be like, howdy, how are you? Like, you know, like, really try to start a conversation when you walk by. And
yeah, Southern friendliness. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll just be like, fuck you. I don't know you. Why are you trying to talk to me?
Yeah, yeah.
But we do have this basic, like, acknowledge that our existence thing. And so, yeah. And then the I didn't know there was a further degree from the unfriendly New York, which is, like, when I came here and people, like, actually pretend you're not there sometimes when you walk by them on the street. They just look straight because they're uncomfortable. And I'm like, do I look weird? Like, is something wrong?
Yeah.
You know?
Cause it, especially for people like me, I have kind of social anxiety. So when I meet people on the street and it's just one person and I'm just one, I have that. Okay, here we go. Now we're getting closer. Am I looking at the person? Should I look over to the building? No, but if I do that, then it feels like I try to avoid that person. And then they might feel like, why is he avoiding me? So maybe I should look at him. But okay, no. Now they look back at me and, like, what the fuck is he looking at? Okay, look down. No, but that looks weak. No.
Yeah.
That whole thought process.
I realized that, like, at first I was really offended, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And I was also offended when I saw someone I knew on the street and they pretended not to see me, which is quite common here as well.
It is, yeah. Because I have that thing I just told you about.
And I think part of it is because they either don't know what to do and they feel uncomfortable, or they don't want to impose on someone's privacy and talk to them if maybe they're in a hurry or don't want to talk back.
Sure.
And it took me a really long time to understand the thought process. And once you know the thought process, you don't feel offended anymore. But it takes a really long time when you're just like, do they not like me? I saw them yesterday. Do they not recognize me? Like, you get really confused, you know?
Yeah.
So now that I really understand the psyche of a Swede, I feel like I can kind of, you know how to frame it in my mind, like an awkward social interaction that happened. But before, I was creating all these ideas in my head of, like, the things I was doing wrong and being really self-conscious myself. So
can you see it slowly changing because of all the mixing up when immigration is ramping up, especially in areas where there's more mix and stuff like that? Because
I think so. I mean, I've only been here for 3.5 years, so don't know what it was like.
No,
you know?
It's too short of a span.
I think that there are a lot, you do see a lot of people, you know, mixing, and you do see a lot of people who take interest in another culture through a person who's lived here. And so, you know, I think of, like, these women that work at the pharmacy near where I live, and they all have, like, their names in Arabic around their neck. And I think these kinds of things are really cool to see, because you're, like, these little elements of people kind of trying to, you know, incorporate another culture or another person's culture, or get to know something different. And also, like, around music a lot, I think. See this.
Yeah. I mentioned this before with another guest. I think when two cultures meet, the best things from each culture boils to the surface, and the bad things start going away. Because you see the alternatives and see what, hey, this works. This, I like this.
Yeah.
So I think mingling is most often a good thing.
Yeah.
Since I've lived most of my life in Sweden, I've seen some subtle differences. Some of them are, of course, because people around me grow older with me. But I seem to remember like a period where all my friends, male friends especially, just went from going, "Yeah, hi, how you doing?" to shaking hands. I'm like, are we shaking hands now? Why are we doing this? I think that might have been just because we were getting older. But all of a sudden, a couple of years ago, everybody started hugging. So now it's common for male friends to hug in Sweden. But 25 years ago, no. So those things do happen. And that might be because of, you know, world influence, I think.
Mm. I thought you guys were all huggers just from the beginning.
No, that's like this the past 10 years, maybe.
Okay. I thought it was very interesting how people can feel so kind of shy, but then they have to hug at the end of an interaction. Mm. I was like, how did that end up to be like that? But maybe it was a slow...
It's a slow boil, yeah. And it started with you hugged your female friends, but not your male friends. And then that has changed as well. Okay. Just 'cause we, like, okay, it's okay. Yeah, we need some time probably. So, okay, so that film about Asylum, what's the name of the film?
It's kind of has a lot of working titles, so I don't really know if I want to give it a name. It's not done.
It's not done, so no. it's not listed anywhere.
No, it's really hard to make a personal film.
Yep.
It's also really hard to get it funded, and it's hard... I found an editor that I really like that I'm working with, that I have been working with, but I also have to pay. Mm. And I think I needed a bit of space from it to figure out the direction I wanted to go with it, because I also want to write a screenplay about the whole experience. And I feel like...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I feel like... And a book, actually. I've took notes the entire last maybe... 6 years of my life, I've been taking notes on various life experiences and potential films, screenplays that I want to write, even if it was a day or a 2 hour period where I'm like, wow, I can't believe that just happened to me. That would make a great short film. Let me write it down, you know?
Yeah.
And so for this entire experience, I would like to write a screenplay because it's very complicated and it's also very sensitive. And I feel like there's a lot of details that I don't have to leave out if I make it fictional.
Mm.
So then the question is, what do I do around the documentary? And then I was like, well, maybe I would edit the documentary myself and make it a bit more anonymous and make it more of like a little bit more, less traditional documentary and more of like a expressive kind of artistic film, where I could talk a bit more about the emotional side of it and less about like all of the like scenarios and circumstances where I could leave that for the narrative. So I'm trying to figure out how they would work together. And I've been working in documentary for, I don't know what year is it, for like the last 5 years, but I'm really like starting to get this like itch for narrative.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's interesting because like I feel like growing up, I was always like, I didn't like writing.
Mm.
Like it was just because you had to write academically in school and you had to like write these essays and they had to have this format and it turned me off from writing.
I get that. Yeah.
And then like as I've gotten older and I've like just been writing things like documenting and writing and then started writing some blog posts about my experience living in Sweden and these kinds of things. I realized I really like writing. I just don't like writing when someone's telling me what to write or how to do it and, you know, in this confined form.
Yeah.
So now I'm kind of shifting. And of course, I don't know, maybe I'm just this person that like you start to like become very good at something or become somewhat successful and then you're like, oh, that's enough, let me shift and do something else, and you never like kind of let it fully like develop. I think I'm one of those people who's just done so many things. Maybe I'm afraid of being successful, perhaps.
Yep. I can relate. I've done too many things. Yeah. So you know, jack of all, master of none, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm trying not to do that. I'd like to think that I could control that, but Or it's perhaps you're just one of those, I heard this term on a podcast, like a life learner. I like that term because I feel like I identify with that. I'm always just wanting to learn new things.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And skills. Mm-hmm. But that also means you're a little bit antsy and you like don't always hone it fully.
No, you don't want to jump to the next thing. Yeah. And don't get stuck and bogged down and everything. Yeah. But this documentary is going to be a feature length,
I believe. That is the plan as of now. Or I've also thought about maybe a few short films. I don't really know. Like, I have to figure out how it's taken so many forms. Like, I have a rough cut as a feature traditional documentary. I don't know. It's hard to locate yourself in it as well when it's about you, but you've shot it and directed it and it's about someone else as well. It's just been really hard to, you know, I've screened the rough cut in New York and had great feedback and told people, like one woman came up and was like, you should submit this to Sundance immediately, like these kinds of things. And I'm like, it is in no form where I will submit it anywhere because it's just not right. But I don't really know what right is yet.
That's tricky. If you don't know what's done, then I mean, sure, if they think, oh, this is done, send it immediately, and you know, no, it's not done. I know when it's done. But if you don't know when it's done either.
I know it's when it's not done.
Yeah, exactly. So you think there's going to be a point that's going to be like surprise you, and all of a sudden you feel, oh, shit. Yeah, I think it's done now.
I think that's usually how creating, for me anyways, goes. It's like so intuitive and you just kind of keep going until you hit a point where you're like, okay, this is what I want it to be.
I always have the same kind of feeling, you know, when you leave your home and think that you forgot something. You forgot your keys, you forgot your cell phone or whatever. I have that feeling when I finish anything creatively. Like, okay, it's done now. Is it? What did I... I've forgotten something, haven't I?
I feel that on the technical, but not on the content.
Okay. I feel, since I do everything also, usually, I can, the technical, definitely.
So maybe like color correcting or fixing some sound stuff, I would feel that.
There must be a clip that's not color corrected. Yeah.
Something like it wasn't transitioned properly. But in terms of content, no, I feel like the content and the flow and everything, I hit a point where I'm like satisfied.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's probably good. You have a couple of short documentaries behind you. I checked your IMDb, so I know. Yeah. Unfortunately, I haven't seen any of them as of yet. And one of them is about the immigrant situation also, right?
Which one did you watch?
Something about one of the Syrian refugees that was a hairdresser or something?
It's not done.
It's not done? Okay.
And it's fiction.
That's fiction?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a first screenplay. Yeah. I'm writing it with I have two co-writers in Malmö. Syrian filmmakers.
Oh, yeah?
And, it's also my first like collaborative creative.
That's scary.
It's really interesting. I mean, I like collaboration. I think that there's so much that you realize when you're collaborating with people that you didn't think of. Or there's so many alternative ways that things could go.
Yep.
And even if someone proposes something that you don't agree with, it sparks something new.
Definitely.
So I really like that process. Right. Also because I had this idea for a film that I knew was going to be in Arabic. And my Arabic is not at the point where I can write a screenplay by any means.
Right. Well, you know some at least.
Yeah. So, I mean, I get the feel of the flow of the language and the dialogue. And if I, you know, we've been talking about this because we just got support from Swedish Film Institute for production. And now
that's big.
Yeah, we're really excited. Now we're like, oh, we're really doing this. and so we're planning, you know, how are we going to break down the tasks of what's next. And and then we had to talk about, look, okay, you're directing a film that's not in your native language.
Mm.
How are you going to feel about that? Do I have a translator? Like, what language are the actors going to speak? Like, all of this.
Mm.
And trying to think about, because in the documentary that I did a lot of editing on my own when I shot half in the West Bank, and I did a lot of editing in Arabic, and I was okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I could edit. I mean, I could edit fine. But I was also editing someone who I knew really well, so I understood his way of speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to be a bit different. So I really just have to get to know the script really well.
Mm.
And if I know the script, I think I'll be fine in terms of the language,
because
I understand enough Arabic. I just probably will need to learn a lot of new vocabulary words. But I think directing will be hard, and there will be subtle things in the language and in the mannerisms that need to be consistent culturally that I think I will have to have help and advice, because for accuracy and for the feeling and for, you know, I recognize that I can't do that alone.
No, because they have an insane amount of words, and between the different dialects, the discrepancies are huge, what I understand.
But we'll at least have control since it's a script.
Yeah.
So, but we do have different characters who speak different dialects.
Oh, that too. Okay.
And I think it's just more of like, is it realistic for someone to make this expression when they say this word and this kind of thing? But I'm up for the challenge.
Good.
It's pretty exciting to, you know, being in documentary, you basically create the film in the edit.
Yeah.
And suddenly, like in fiction, you have all this control. And it's really nice. It's really, you know, but it's scary at the same time because you have so many possible choices and you want to make the best choice for the situation and for the project. So it's a, there's some growing pains there.
Yeah, I understand. I bet that one of the big reasons that you could get funding from the Swedish Film Institute is that it's such a urgent kind of theme for it's going on right now, and it's a big thing for Sweden, because we had all the like tens of thousands of Syrian refugees pouring in a couple of years ago, and so doing something about that is probably, you know, very appreciated from that perspective.
I think also doing something as a team of, I mean, I had been shooting in the camps my last project, and Basel and Allah, my two co-writers, they lived in camps. So a lot of people have tried to tell stories, but they've been people like onlookers. But it's, you know, different when you have people who have firsthand experiences. And we're trying to like talk about the subtleties that aren't really talked about in the news and this and that. It's more about like the everyday lives of people who are just kind of in this liminal phase of waiting for an answer.
Yeah, we have no idea about all those subtleties. I haven't even seen one of those camps. I just know that they exist somewhere.
And also the dynamics between all the different people. I mean, people are just like, oh, everybody's from a certain area of the world, they'll all get along and they're all the same, let's put them in place. But
no.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's political differences, there's a religious difference, there are cultural differences, there's differences between personalities.
Yeah.
There's, you know, so many differences. And then people are just, you know, put in randomly in rooms with other people without considering that when you have a lot of political conflict going on, which just that in and of itself is like, could be a huge issue. So we're trying to address those issues and say like you have a building full of people who have like lost a lot. A lot of people have gone through trauma to get here, or losing people they know. And then suddenly, like, you could be sharing a room with like someone who, you know, believes something completely different than you do.
Yeah.
And it opens those wounds in a sense. So
of course, yeah.
I mean, that we want to address things like this because
we've had those problems since like the 60s and 70s with the projects. Like, okay, we just stuff everybody who's coming here into the same area, into depressing concrete buildings, and just go. Oh, problems? Why are there problems? You know, for these reasons, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, one thing, maybe because it's the first time I'm really on the other side, I've lived in quite a few other countries, but haven't tried to really insert myself in society in the same way. But there is this slight like category of like native or immigrant. And you kind of feel this like, oh, well, you're not from here. So in some sense, you're put in this big category. I'm not saying everyone does this, but they're in certain, maybe it's like in certain policies or in certain, you know, ways of having to, you know, sign up for some program or whatever. You are like divided. And it's strange to be in that category. Like, I never really thought about it before. And it's like almost like you're in the know or you're not in the know. Like, you didn't grow up here. You don't know just how all these things work. So suddenly you're just in this other category. And yeah, it's just quite interesting to experience. I have a background in anthropology, so I'm just kind of like endlessly doing field work and studying these kinds of things, even on myself. So
anthropology, not social anthropology.
Yeah, social.
Social anthropology. Okay.
Yeah.
So you read all about like strange tribes in South America and all that stuff that comes with the territory.
Yeah, yeah, all of that theory.
Tell me about other projects you've done, film projects and stuff.
I made a short film that premiered in the Seattle International Film Festival and then at the London Short Film Festival.
Oh yeah.
About a 78-year-old man that I was actually friends with, and his kind of the evolution of his kind of like sexual identity over his lifetime. He's just like a really, I'm really drawn to like really interesting, complex people. I just like doing portraits on film portraits on people who have really kind of unique perspectives or ways of articulating themselves, or like so this character, he you know, he kind of like flirts with the line of like liking, he slips up in his interviews about liking boys, men, you know, like
into S&M.
But he talks about it in a very intellectual way where you kind of grasp like why you would like something like this, or how this kind of satisfies certain needs.
Probably because he had a lot of time to think about that, being 78.
Yeah, that's true. But this like psychological element of things that I think a lot of people look at as taboo, for example, I like breaking this barrier. I like breaking the barrier in general of what's taboo. I think it's important to question, you know, these social constructions we create about things, and I find that super interesting. And just anything related to like psychology and social issues and identity construction, like these are the topics I really like to make films about. Yeah, I mean, now to talk about something else creative, but maybe not, I'm not sure if I'm considered an artist in this sense, but like...
Well, you're on Inglourious Artist Records.
Yeah, I'm an artist, but in this other aspect, out of what we've been talking about, like feeling like a little bit like I don't know how things work and out, you know, trying to integrate and all of this and breaking taboo, I ended up creating this app as well.
Yeah.
To try to kind of break the taboo of loneliness.
Yeah,
that's talking about loneliness.
Interesting way of thinking about it.
But that's really what I would like to do, because it's you feel lonely because you feel like you can't talk about it, about your own loneliness. But then when I came to Sweden, to be honest, this is going to sound strange, but like I saw this like really deep loneliness in people that I'd never experienced before.
Yeah, we single households in Sweden are sky high.
Yeah.
So there's something about that.
There was this like feeling that I couldn't really articulate, but I just met a lot of people with this feeling of this like deep loneliness.
Mm. Yeah, I get that. I see that.
And then I started to kind of get why. And then I struggled with it in the winters. I'm used to cold, but I'm not used to the darkness.
Mm.
So I struggled quite a bit with that. And you feel like, yeah, you're not supposed to talk about this. But then at the same time, I met a lot of Swedes who were just like, yeah, we're lonely people. You know, like it's okay to talk about and say this. Whereas, I mean, you can't say that in the US. You can't even like admit I'm lonely. Maybe if you're like 90 or something.
It's a bit of stigma.
Yeah.
A bit of stigma around it.
So okay. I thought like, I really want to break this. And also I wanted to kind of try to solve this problem where like I didn't know how to meet people who were like, it took me a really long time to find other filmmakers. I was like going and couch surfing and other websites, like searching filmmaker keywords and stuff. And thinking like, wow, I just wish I could like open something like Tinder and type in the word film and find all the people, filter them all out who like the same thing. And so then I ended up creating this app, Panion, that does just that. And somehow it made me feel better about like all of the work I've done and understanding integration and like people feeling lonely and all of this stuff that I had been confronted with. Like suddenly I feel like, okay, I can take all that and like put it into something. But now I have this struggle a bit just with my own identity as an artist, because I'm also running this tech startup, which is a totally different world. And I've like...
Well, it matches the app developing.
The app developing, the tech part, everything. But also like going to film events and feeling like, but I'm really a filmmaker, you know, like I miss, because it's taking a lot of my time. Like I'm yet again dividing myself and doing another thing.
Yeah.
And like, where is my identity here? Am I a filmmaker? Am I an app developer? Am I a CEO of a tech startup? Like I'm having this like little identity crisis again.
And unfortunately, usually people around you have that, you know, almost projects that crisis onto you because people want to put labels on people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Melanie, that, you know, the documentary filmmaker, you mean the app developer? No. Well, okay. Now, but what is she? You know, they want to put you in a little box. So when you say that, no, I do this too, you can see like the kind of the interest go away from their face. Like, okay, this person doesn't even know who they are.
Or they're not very focused.
No. No, exactly. And they want you to be focused, especially if if you're looking for a collaborator in one of these fields and they find out that you do all those other things.
Exactly.
They kind of lose interest in you, don't they?
Yeah.
Because they're like, okay, then you're not going to be 100% focused on our thing.
Right.
And, oh, that's frustrating.
It's frustrating. And I also want to say, like, okay, in a place where it's winter a lot of the time and I have to distract myself from falling down a black hole, I have to be creating things. So the fact that I have lots of projects actually saves me. Some people actually do better having a lot of things they're passionate about and it's not a distraction. So I think it depends who you are and how you handle your projects. So I don't like that people can often kind of judge or categorize if you're doing too many things or you're doing two different things, because I think you can be good at things that are vastly different from
each
other.
Most definitely, yeah. But I think the key is that you do one thing, you become good at it, and you become known for that thing. And yeah. then you start doing other things.
Exactly.
And then people like, oh, that's so cool. He's also a podcaster and he is a novelist and yeah. blah, blah, blah. But we know him as a musician first and foremost, you know, yeah. you know that kind of thing. And people like talking about Donald Glover or Stephen Fry or David Bowie. I mean, people like that. But if they did everything on the ground floor at the same time, then they probably would be like confusing people.
Yeah.
And I've done the mistake of confusing people. Maybe you feel that way too.
I definitely do.
Okay.
Yeah. Or you don't tell the whole story of who you are to everyone. Mm. And then they see you as one thing and then other people see you as another. But then you all end up meeting in the same place and there gets confusion there.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's hard because I think these two worlds that I'm in are very different. And I almost see them as different because I see the split in Malmo. Like
mm-hmm.
This like Milan artist feel, and then there's the like startup tech entrepreneur world on the like northern part of the city.
Yeah.
And it's geographically split. So I almost feel a bit of a culture shock when I go between the two. Mm. And that mirrors the like divide in this identity. And so it's kind of strange and interesting and confusing, and I'm like trying to work it out in my head, but also trying not to think too hard about it because maybe it doesn't need to be resolved.
No. I don't know. And the split is social, socioeconomic as well.
Yeah.
Which is kind of annoying.
Yeah.
Hmm. Like the tech world in that sense is a bit more upper middle classy in that sense. Yeah. Hmm. I hope that gets mixed up more.
Yeah, I think but the thing is, I almost want to just label myself as like a creator because I think all of those people are creating. Yeah, they're creative. Maybe they're creative in a business sense or in a technological sense or in more, you know, creating a film or a piece of art or something. But people are producing things and you can kind of connect over that because it takes drive and passion to do that. Mm, so.
Yeah. A previous guest on here, Rick Jacobs, he said that he presents himself as a creative since he's a director, producer on different levels and stuff like that. So now it's just easier for him to say, I'm a creative and I do these kind of things.
Yeah.
But what do you think is... collected under that umbrella of being a creative, where's the limit to call yourself a creative? Because I know a lot of people who are in jobs that are not traditionally being called creative jobs, maybe, but they're like, well, I'm being creative. I'm being creative with my computer code. Yeah, you are, I guess. But is that being a creative, or is that a creative endeavor? I don't know.
I think it's like the same thing with this artist label or musician label.
Mm.
You know, can you call yourself a musician because you've picked up the guitar for 2 weeks now? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, we've been talking about that as well. That's a big theme for this pod.
Yeah. I'm sure that drives you crazy.
No, I find it so interesting.
Yeah.
But thinking about it and defining it, that kind of drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I feel like, okay, if you get paid for something, that means you're professional.
Yeah.
And that means you can label yourself as that thing. But maybe no, maybe it's just it's your focus. It's what you define yourself as. Yeah, if you pick up that guitar, play for 2 weeks, and you don't do much anything else, and your plan is to, I'm going to be a guitarist, and that's my main focus, then I guess you're a musician from that moment on.
Hmm.
Unless, I don't know. Like, who defines what you are? Is it more you or other people?
Yeah. It's hard. I remember having this situation where I had this friend who decided suddenly he wanted to be a photographer, and I had been working as a photographer for years.
Mm.
And suddenly he wanted a lot of advice, but at the same time he was, you know, had just started but built this whole website and like this kind of appearance that he was quite professional. And then when we would go to parties, would introduce himself as a photographer.
Yeah, okay.
And then I felt like when I introduced myself second as a photographer, it was kind of like, oh, like it kind of, like, how do you know how do you know, like, that maybe I've been working for a very long time as a professional photographer and he, like, just picked up a few weeks ago, but yeah. The label is the label, you know?
Yeah, you're the one with the skills, he's the one with the dreams or something.
Yeah, and you start to, like, I did feel a little bit like, well, if anyone can just suddenly be a photographer, like, what all that work I've put in, I mean, it's not about labels, of course, but there's just that moment where you're kind of like, you put so little time and effort, but you get to kind of have the same surface appearance. And I don't know, there was something there that was a little bit.
It's really tricky. It's really tricky. So I think it's got to be some kind of combination, a validation from the outside world that, yes, you are this now, and that you feel it yourself, some kind of meld between the two somewhere, you're going to meet in the middle. So he needed the outside validation probably a little bit more, a confirmation that, okay, look at all this body of work that I've done. Because sometimes struggling actors like myself, if we haven't gotten an actual gig, paid gig that's professional and seen by a lot of people, be it on stage or screen or whatever, maybe for a year, you start feeling, am I even an actor anymore?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so, but, you know.
Yeah.
And how much other things can you do in the meantime before you start losing that label?
Yeah. I felt really strange at the beginning stating that I was a filmmaker.
Mm.
You remember, I went to film school, and then just using that word to describe myself, I felt very
pretentious,
fraudulent
even. Oh.
Because I was like, but I've gone to film school, but does that make me a filmmaker? Like, shouldn't I have made at least two or three films before I'm a filmmaker? Like, I just didn't know where the line was. And I didn't want to, like, proclaim myself as something and then maybe, you know, again, like, maybe it's, I mean, because we only have this one word for someone who's maybe won like 5 Oscars and someone who's done a student film.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've done a couple of, you know, short stuff. I mean, a web series and a short documentary and stuff like that. But I don't call myself a filmmaker. I've said that I've done some filmmaking.
Because
I've just dipped into that,
but
it's not something I've continued doing. So I guess you're right about that. You have to do a couple of things first and feel like you're on that momentum and have that intention as well.
Yeah,
because I asked a world famous feature director that I worked with, just kind of what he, I don't really remember what we talked about and how I. If I asked a specific question, but I remember him saying, I mean, he was five features into his career, and he's just, I'm a beginner. He still considered himself being a beginner filmmaker. And I guess so, yeah.
It's also evolving like crazy. I mean, I feel like that as a cinematographer. I mean, if you aren't keeping up on the latest news and trends and cameras and everything, you know, when you are going to go on another shoot, you have to kind of reacquaint yourself with like what's happened since. And is there a better camera than the last time I shot on and that I should be using? And I mean, you realize partly when you do a lot of things that there's a lot of catch up if you're not constantly just doing that one thing all the time. So I've thought about just working as like a DOP and not directing or doing anything else because I really like shooting a lot. And the freedom it would give me to just spend all my time and energy like focusing on improving my craft, learning about the different cameras that are coming out and technique and all of this.
Because it moves so fast now as well.
It moves so fast. But at the same time, I'm like one of those believers in that it's not 100%. It's not about your equipment and it's more about the story you're telling and, you know, you can light with so many things. Mm. You don't need to have the top lighting equipment if you understand the concepts and you have the eye. And So I like to kind of stick with that line of thinking. Mm. But I think it's both. I mean, I think you should be kind of
aware, I guess.
Aware and, you know, inspired by other people's work and keeping up on certain, you know, elements, technical elements that you need to. But it's, you know, it's a juggle. It's a balance. So
might depend on how technical the thing is. If you if you're an artist who paints, then you might not have been aware of any advancements in that for 30 years, but you're still a painter and you're still probably good at it because you got your oils and your canvases and your brushes, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to move into the digital world or anything like that. But also met people who learned how to be web coders and web designers back in the 90s.
Yeah, and that's changed. Like, but crazy. Yeah,
and like today, though, if they're not aware of JavaScript and CSS, then they can't really call themselves a web developer anymore if they haven't kept up to speed. So I guess it depends.
Mm.
But tell me more about Panion. I mean, that's exciting stuff. I've had all manners of creative people on this podcast, but I never had an app developer. Really.
No.
So could you liken it to like a Tinder but for interests?
A platonic Tinder that's keyword searchable.
Mm.
So we have so many dating apps out there.
Yeah.
I think there's no point in me adding another.
No.
But there are not a lot of friend apps. There are a lot of attempts at friend apps that often have dating counterparts, which means that there's very physical appearance focused, which I don't know about you, but like, I care a lot more about what's inside of my friends than how they look.
Yeah. Well, friends, yeah.
So those don't do a lot for helping you really find the right person to connect with.
No.
And then there's a lot of paragraphs that you're required to fill out for other apps and a lot of like very static information.
Mm.
And so it's not very smart. It's not searchable. It's people don't like writing about themselves, so they usually keep it blank.
Mm.
So you really still end up with this picture. So with Panion, it's all about words, and it's you can tap them, and it's very easy to add them, and it's kind of it's fun, and it prevents people from having empty profiles and. It's different, you know. It's like if you don't have to make sentences and sound witty and funny and like all of these things, but you can just all be equal and have words that describe you, and then see your overlaps with people or run searches for people that have the same interest or an interest you want to learn about or something like
but
that.
But it is interest focused.
It's interest focused, but not just interests, but values and experiences.
Okay.
As well, so it might not be like. It could be kayaking or something, but it could also be like veganism. I mean, it's an interest, but it's also kind of a value. Or it could be like a religion. It could be a, anything that can be like a word, really. It's user generated, so you can request words.
Mm.
And we build out the word bank based on people's requests and if more than one person requests it. So it's supposed, it can go in any direction. The point is that people, we're trying to create a tool that people can kind of use the way they want and help us shape it in the direction that they want it, they want it available to them.
Mm. So it's not really personality based because the personalities don't really show themselves in that traditional sense, but it might be reflective in all those kind of descriptive keywords. If you're a carnivorous Catholic kayaker, then that's probably says something about a person already there.
Exactly. And we've been talking to actually someone in Stockholm who's developed this personality profiling test to try to incorporate some like behind the scenes personality profile.
Kind of like a Myers-Briggs.
Yeah. So it's this test. We don't really want people to take the test, but we want to take elements of how, what certain categories of different types of people and how they interact with others around them, and take elements of that and try to use that. We're using like AI in the back end to try to learn about people and learn through like what interests. I mean, certain interests tend to be very consistently linked to certain personality types.
Sure.
And so you use these kinds of theories to create these profiles about the people, and then to use certain principles that say, okay, people who are similar like this tend to get along better with people who are like have this personality type, and to try to build these profiles and be very methodical about how what we consider as compatible in terms of personality. But it's not something you would necessarily see in your experience. It's something that we're considering behind the scenes in the algorithm. And so we are thinking about personality quite a bit, but we want like the users or the people using it to focus on more the experience of looking for things that are either in common or are something you're interested in that someone can teach you or you could experience with someone else.
Or if you need a collaborator,
or if you need a documentary film subject, yeah. I mean, you could type in a word. Maybe you're doing something on like reggae. You could type that in and see everyone nearby who's some connection to that topic.
And find some person who can be a subject or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's so many uses.
Find a drummer for your band or something like that. Yeah. That's probably really helpful.
I feel like there's so many ways that you can use it, and especially for people that move around. I mean, I travel alone a lot, and I travel for work quite a bit. And if I just even want to have dinner because I'm like somewhere for 3 days by myself, but I want to have dinner with someone I know I can have a conversation with because we have similar starting points. I mean, that alone is really valuable to me, and I think to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. I think this might be really helpful overall as well, because I mean, sometimes you just get into circles of friends because you happen to meet somebody at a party or something, and then they already have their circle of friends, and then you start hanging out with them as well. But it might not be your crowd, really. It just happens to be because you were in the same place at the same time and had some things in common, and then it just kept going. I remember once a bunch of years ago where I was sitting at a restaurant with a group of people who were like a circle of friends, and I kind of got in there from the flank through one of the people there, and it wasn't really my type of people, I felt in a way. And I noticed the table next to us was a group of really interesting people, like, they look more like my kind of people. And then I heard a couple of things that we're talking about. Like, that's so much more interesting. I just felt like getting up from my table thing, thank you, and go to the other table and just sit down and go, yo, you're my people, let's go.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm at the wrong table.
Yeah.
So Panion might help in, you know, to find your people, probably.
Yeah, and I think especially as you get older, and you really start to know yourself better, you know, very instantly, this is not a type of person I get along with.
Yeah, that definitely is the case when it comes to dating.
And with dating also.
You know what you don't want.
Yeah, you know yourself really well, you know, by, you know, late 20s, early 30s, at least I think most people by then know I'm, you know, this type of personality doesn't work with me. And I know that even with like hiring people, I mean, like all sorts of things.
Yeah, of course.
So if you know that, then, and I see this a lot through interests as well. Like I can tell like with certain interests, what kind of person someone might be. Like I know, for example, like every time I meet someone who studied anthropology, like there's a certain type of mindset that you develop from studying that, you know, you're quite, you know, open-minded about people from other places and you think about relativity, cultural relativity, all of this, that does shape your personality and your values.
Yep.
So, I mean, there are a lot of keywords that really would trigger, you know, I know this person and I could probably have a lot to talk about and could be there, like we could potentially really get along. And so I think there is, you know, a lot of personality in there in some sense and not in all the words, but some people like actually just want an activity partner as well.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's also fine.
Yeah. It might not matter that they're pro-choice or not if you just want to play badminton.
Exactly.
Or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you have any other ideas in the app world?
I mean, I'm always like hitting these little obstacles in life where I'm like, I wish there was, you know, something that did this. And then I write it down and keep a list. But honestly, it's a really hard thing to do to like start a company and take an idea from nothing in the tech world.
Yeah. I never dared to.
Yeah. I think like I have a long way to go with this one. It's going to be a long time before I think about the next one. And I have to see, you know.
But how do you go? How do you go about it? I mean, I guess you're not a programmer or stuff like that. So you have to get the idea and then you got to get a team together to actually do the thing, execute it.
Exactly.
So what is that process like? What do you do?
It's really hard. I mean, building teams is like the hardest thing I've ever had to do. A lot of research, a lot of failure, and realizing I wish someone like created a manual for this because
there probably is some book or something.
Yeah, I've failed a lot. I feel like
that's how you succeed.
Yeah, I feel like I've been kind of like reaching around like blindly in the dark for a lot of these past few months. And I also feel like I've been perpetually outside my comfort zone more than I can ever remember being. And I've run away and lived in a lot of countries before, but this has been really difficult. It's an entirely new world. And I mean, I've been like on stage pitching. I am a behind the camera person.
Okay.
So, I've been in investor meetings, pretending that I am super confident about everything I'm saying. It's been a ride. You know, so far.
You talked about it in the press and stuff, in media.
I've been in a lot of press, which also is hard, like I said, behind the scenes. Being the face of something is scary, especially in a, when it's being published in a language that you're not super proficient in yet. So you hope no one twists your words.
They do.
They always do.
They always do.
Yeah.
I've written for a small paper myself, and we had the luxury, because we did like 4 issues a year or something, to actually show everybody we talked to and interviewed the material before we published it. And there was always something. Where did you get this from? Didn't you say that? I guess I misunderstood. So there was always something to correct.
Yeah.
And media, newspapers, whatever, they don't have that time luxury. So there's going to be mistakes all the freaking time.
Yeah.
And there is. I mean, every time I've said something and being good, I didn't say that. They just assumed because of something else I said.
Yeah. But you see it even in like major newspapers like New York Times. There's always a bottom edit of something they did wrong.
Yeah, from the
time.
Day before. Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's scary. I mean, I'm starting to like it a bit, I think. Like, I realize I like talking. I like talking about issues and telling stories and telling your own story in terms of getting people to know about an initiative that you're trying to move forward. It works. So I think that part of why we've been able to get so much press and in that way is because I've used my storytelling and I've pitched it as a story. And so, I mean, there's a lot of articles out there about for tech people, like don't send, you know, like the fact that you're like launching a product is not newsworthy. It's not. It's, you know, everyone's doing it all the time. You have to have more of a story than that.
So what's your story?
I mean, my story is that I came to a country, like I really broke every social rule, had no idea how to integrate, was interviewing people that also were struggling to integrate and realized there was just this big gap that needed to be filled. And then, you know, simultaneously went on a lot of dating apps to try to make friends and failed miserably there as well. Had some very screenplay worthy experiences.
Yeah, good collecting experiences.
And finally was like, I'm just going to create a solution, because I talked about the solution for a while and had all these people calling me like, is your app ready yet? As if you could just make an app in like 10 days.
No.
So a lot of people were really remembering this idea I had and continuously like contacting me like, come on, do it, like I'm waiting for it. So then I felt this responsibility and started to actually do it.
Yeah, that's a good story. You saw a demand for something and you met the demand. You tried to solve the problem.
Yeah.
And how long is this process from like when you? I mean, technically, the nerdy side of it. You get a team together and they start developing in it, and you try to get a functioning beta version ready. I mean, this is.
But it's never ending.
Of course, you always do new versions and stuff.
Well,
like that.
Well, things are also always breaking.
How long and how difficult is the process to get from okay, let's start to let's release. First version?
It's like months and months and months of work. And I mean, I, looking back, did it completely wrong. Because I had no experience.
But you had people who knew a bit more about it, I guess.
Kind of. I tried to take on a lot of roles myself.
Okay.
And was way too overly ambitious. I think trying to create this ideal thing that I hadn't completely tested. So when you build something and it's only in your head, but you haven't like done the entire user journey to think about like and tested it on people to see like, oh, that person didn't interpret that button that way. You realize that you can't create a product based on your own user journey only. And also like a lot of things overly complicate, you know, a product. Like we think about the apps that you delete, a lot of them have too many functions. So, and I didn't know anything about any of this. So now if I were to make a second app, I would approach everything differently. And I would have, but now I kind of sometimes have to go backwards a little bit and kind of say, let's hold off on this feature, simplify it so that people actually understand how this part of the product works, and we can add that later if there's a demand for it and in a way that makes more sense to the people so they can find it. So it's really, I've learned so much. And there are people who professionally do these kinds of things like user experience design. But I think it's hard. I mean, right now I'm working with people that really talented people that do this, but I didn't have resources. So no. I mean, it was just me building something with no money at the beginning and then getting some family and friends money. So I did as much as I could myself, as people do. And then you learn, and then you get a little bit of resources and you can bring people on and find collaborators who are passionate about it. And, you know.
And your collaborators, your team, was that like a combination of beginners and experienced people? So you actually had some help along the way, people who saw what worked and didn't, and then enthusiastic people who I need to learn too.
It's a combination. And it's hard finding people. You have to find people that are passionate, which is great, which is the hardest part. But then you also have to find people that can take initiative and kind of be self-motivated, because in a startup, everyone's juggling a lot of roles. And if you can't kind of take things and try to own them and take your responsibilities and do the best you can, obviously consult with your team. But like, it's so high stress and it moves so fast that you really need people that like can kind of be like, okay, maybe I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to need you to kind of come tell me along the way
how to do it. Right. Don't worry about it. This is going to happen.
Exactly.
Even though you don't make it happen and tell me. Yeah.
And surprisingly, those people are very hard to find.
I believe you. I believe they are.
Yeah.
So,
you learn a lot about yourself in general, yourself as like a leader, yourself as your personality type and what you're good at and what you're capable at and what capable of and what you, what types of personalities are right for the values you have for your company and for you. And like, that's a lot of stuff that's been really hard, I think, is I never had to think about that before because I always worked as a freelancer by myself. And then suddenly you're like, okay, well, I've actually made lists of my values to see if like the people I'm working with align with them. And then values for my company and how I want it to be, values for my product and what I want it to feel like for the people using it so that there's consistency and that the people we're bringing on can be like, yeah, I agree with that. Let's do it. Or that's not me. And then you know that you can find someone else.
I guess that's more important. Because the skill side, most people have enough skill if they're in a field, and if they don't, they can learn. But the type of person they are is a whole other bag. So I guess that's what you want to find out in a job interview.
Yeah.
More like, who is this person? Because what they can do and what they've done, it's going to be enough probably.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it's and then we have this. The guy in Stockholm that we've been talking to about the personality theories and tests, who was like, let me just profile all the people before you hire them and see if they match with your personality. And then you can make a decision.
Yeah, okay. Use the app you're working on to find people.
So, I mean, it's interesting. I never really thought so much about it before I've been confronted with it. And there's also a lot of cultural things with people from different countries who have different work ethics, different practices. You see a lot of different... I just never had to work with people. So you see a lot of things that you never thought about until you do.
I guess, yeah. It's a learning process along the way. And I guess this takes up a lot of your time. Is that frustrating that you may not have enough time to work on your documentary or even your coming narrative feature and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm trying to find a balance. And then I have to also balance my own personal life.
Oh, you have one of those as well?
Yeah, which I'm learning how to do. I thought Sweden was teaching me that quite well. And then I decided to take on too many things. But yeah, it's been hard. And I think what I think is, like, I want to build the app company to a point where I have enough people working with me that I'm not doing everything, or I'm not doing a lot. I'm doing just one role.
Yeah.
And then everyone's doing their roles.
Can carry some weight.
And then I have more time for myself and my projects. But right now I'm working nights and weekends on my films and everything else. And that's fine. But eventually, there will be more balance because maybe we'll have more money and we'll have more employees and it'll be like a normal job that anyone else might have. That's kind of the goal I want to get to. So,
do you feel like you've learned something like positive about the Swedish way of living when it comes to these kind of things? Do you find us to be a bit more relaxed about these kind of things, or the other way around? Or
yeah, definitely.
Do we have more integrity when it comes to our personal life, and like the job stops there?
Yeah, definitely.
It stops here. Yeah,
I'm learning from that a lot, and okay. I really like people don't respond to your emails on the weekends. And at first, it was frustrating, and now it's such a relief because I don't have to respond.
Exactly. It's not expected of you either.
It's really nice. And there are certain things you can say to someone, like your kid being sick or having to go to a doctor's appointment, things that are like basic human rights,
yep.
kind of,
yeah.
that are very tolerated and understood here that aren't yep. back, you know, in a lot of jobs I've been in New mm. York. And just this overall sense of like balance, life quality and balance that I've learned so much
mm.
from living in Sweden. Mm. And I'm still not really very good at it. I'm getting better. Mm-hmm. But like actually having a full day where I don't look at work, I mean, that's right now what I'm doing, mm. getting to, and then hopefully a full weekend and or coming home and just working in the office and not at home. Like I would like to get there and I'm not there yet. Mm. But I would like to like have a physical location where my work is
yeah, that helps. It does.
Yeah. Mm.
I find that even though I don't necessarily have some hours where I go to do this kind of work and a place where I go to do another kind of work and so on, I always, I can have full days when I don't do anything that's productive at all. Just sitting around watching YouTube videos and eating and reading a book and going to the coffee house, whatever. But my mind is always working. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, oh yeah, I gotta update my website, and then I gotta email that person, and because it's always, I mean, it's for an actor, it's always a constant hustle to try to find another yeah. job and whatever. I guess that's not very Swedish because we have our 9-to-5, not really 9-to-5, but our yeah. that kind of to existence 4. Usually. Yeah, 8-to-4. Yeah. It's not as clatchy. And that drains you as mm. well, because you always have to, if your mind is always working, from people who see it from the outside, like, you don't do anything, do you? Well, my brain do.
Yeah.
You know, or does, you know.
Yeah, your brain is always, that's the part that is not as easy to overcome.
Mm.
Like you can say, okay, on Saturday I don't work, but you can't tell your brain to shut off on a Saturday. Like no. you need to. So there's like a lot of meditation involved in this
yeah.
life, this heading towards a balance mm. goal.
And that's, it's worse when it comes to creative things, I think.
Yeah.
Because you're always trying to solve problems.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that is that the right color for the thing yeah. under the.
And your brain. Being a creative brain is always creating,
creating
in every yeah, context.
Yeah. Creatively and, problem solving. And,
yeah. yeah.
But if you were working as a dishwasher, you left and then you don't have to think about washing right. dishes.
And I'm envious of that in a sense. In this a sense. Going home and it's not yours, so you don't have to care about it.
Yeah, no. Mm. And I've almost never or rarely had that kind of, because I always cared in some way. And yeah. The only thing that keeps in the mind of everybody, I guess, it's when it comes to social things. If you have that kind of job and you go home on the weekend, you're still thinking about that asshole mm. at work who always gives yeah. you a hard time. You know,
yeah.
you can't. That's hard to let go.
Yeah.
But,
I had a friend who tattooed behind her ear the. You know, the button that used to be on the Mac, the little circle with the line down the middle, that on button.
It's on off, yeah.
Off
universal.
Or is it universal?
It's a universal oh. on off.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm power clearly on, an yeah. Apple user. Mm. I haven't looked at any other buttons in a while.
Mm-hmm.
She tattooed that behind her ear. And I was like, every time I saw it, I was like, that's how I feel.
Mm.
I just want that.
You want an off switch.
Yeah. I want that switch so badly. And I've seen like a cartoon once of someone like removing their brain before bed and putting it on a shelf.
Oh.
Like those kinds of things. And I'm like, yeah, I relate so much to all of that.
I would like to like hook up my brain to like a system that defragments.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, and throws away the cookies and yeah. stuff, things you don't need and use. Like,
just wait, somebody will come up with some sort of startup that.
I guess so. That I mean, issue. Sometime in the future, we'll probably be able to access our brains like computers and yeah. change things around, like in Westworld. Like, okay, I need a little bit less anxiety, because I can see that the level is high because I accumulated stuff.
Yeah.
Probably it's gonna happen. I guess it's scary, but you know, yeah. have to regulate what you can do and can't do.
Yeah.
So I don't really want a world where everybody walks around being super people either.
No.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's a scary time thinking about all of this.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
That's like a whole other conversation.
It is. It's going to be a long one. Yeah. So what do you want to, of course, you want to plug Panion. It's you want people to download and start using Panion.
That would be wonderful. Yeah. And actually what I really would like besides that is for people to get feedback, because I think one thing that's been really hard, because I've never created a product. I've created films, so it's similar, but criticism is hard when people don't know the behind the scenes and what's gone into something and how much effort you've put into something.
Yeah. And I mean, when it comes to film, it's like if you think it's done and this is what it's going to be, you don't really care if everybody likes it or not. And okay, it's not for you then. But when it comes to the app, I guess like, okay, I got to make sure that everybody can work this and like it.
But you get a lot of angry people that aren't getting exactly the experience they want.
Okay, yeah.
And you kind of want to be like, first of all, if people knew how few people were behind this, maybe they'd be a bit nicer.
Mm.
But secondly, because I've always been very like visual, so I created this like huge website and this huge presence and a lot of branding to make us look like we're a big company, which backfired because there were a lot of expectations on like how fast we respond. And
it's
all
probably
this.
Better to be honest about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was honest. I was just trying to look professional.
Sure.
You know, which helps in some senses. But I guess I just, like, we want feedback. I mean, like, we want to create something for people. And we want people to want to use that and for them to fill a need in their life using Panion.
Mm.
So instead of, like, writing some angry message about how something isn't the way you want, like, write us a very, you know, a constructive message about how we can fix it and then be patient and give us a chance to fix it. Because we're reading everything and our changes are based on our feedback that we get from our customers. We're trying to do something for people and create something that will, you know, be a tool for people. Yeah. So like we're on your side. So consider that. And so, you know, the most valuable thing, which I had never really thought about before, because I'm guilty of like just being like, and deleting an app. But like apps evolve and things change and they can't become something great without people contributing.
I guess that's really helpful to you. If people rate and comment and stuff.
If you believe in what we're doing, before you rate, if you're gonna rate badly, reach out and say like, this is a great concept, but I wish it did this, or this isn't working, and then give us a chance to try to change that.
But don't you have to do both things when you, if you,
no, I mean, you, if we you have write a something feedback on button, you can just,
okay,
send
you
us
have a
directly.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking about like the App Store or Google Play, because have to, when you comment, I guess you have to rate as well.
Because those affect us a lot too. So for example, like Facebook, the whole Cambridge Analytic thing, we just got bombarded with angry messages about how we have a Facebook login, only a Facebook login.
Oh.
And it was like, okay, well, we can change that, and we did. We changed, added a new login, but like, to be fair, like, first of all, it helps us make sure that people are real. It verifies people, so we did it in a way to help make sure there were not lots of spam fake profiles. Secondly, like, be nice and tell us your concern, and we'll change it. But to be angry at us because of something Facebook did. Like it was like,
but not everybody has Facebook, so that's also a good reason not to only have that kind of login.
No, of course, but when you're small and you have no money, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, okay,
and
that
we
was
started
the easiest, best way to.
It's the easiest because it's gives you the most information to like build a profile that's not empty. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, and for us, that we choose certain things. And
do you like import people's interest and tags on Facebook to Panion?
We try to import things based on what people allow us to and want us to, but we don't want to take anything people don't want. But a lot of people are lazy and they want you to. And we can't do that from an email. But the point was that we started somewhere with something that was going to be secure or with, you know, Facebook. I don't know. Secure is the right word. But and we had no money and needed to validate our idea in public. So like what's out there right now, it's not a version one. It's an MVP. It's a beta. It's a trial.
Okay.
So it, you know, it's us trying to see what needs to be done next. Mm. So I guess I just like people to be a little bit less harsh and more like, we're in this together. Let's make this great together.
Sure, but that's overestimating the internet.
Of course.
And people probably. Yeah.
But anyone who's listening could maybe consider that and think like, oh, this has potential. Like maybe if I give my opinion, this could be even, you know, more helpful for me as a tool because it'll grow into, you know, because that's what I feel like how we should see all products. Like now being on the other side, I realize how valuable feedback is. And I also realize that as a consumer, you do have quite a bit of power. Mm. And instead of shutting things down and complaining about something, like write an email, and because maybe that the company didn't know, you know,
change things.
Yeah. I mean, that's if you're making a product, it's for consumers, and therefore people want to shape their products.
Unless they're just after money and make some stupid game with in-game purchases, and
you need people to want your product, to make money. Mm. So, I mean, that's the
one. I just feel like sometimes the app developers make some, you know, clickbaity kind of game within that purchase just to make money for a short while and then shut it down. And,
yeah, true.
Yeah. And we want to make sure that that doesn't happen as much.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, one thing we're trying to do is not just be an app, but be a conversation. Mm-hmm. So like we have a blog and we're trying to talk about issues of adult friendship, what makes a good friend as an adult, how to not have a toxic friendship, like how to recognize, you know, people that are, could be potentially your type of person, all of the stuff we talked about.
So trying to end a toxic relationship.
Yeah, to end a toxic relationship. But this kind of conversation, so that it's like a brand that is about a topic where everyone can engage rather than like, here, take this product that we made and it's just this, you know, like to have something bigger. Mm. So that's kind of the goal.
Mm. Yeah. All right, great. When do you think you're going to have the first official version?
Hopefully in the next month or two. It all depends on funding and investment.
Oh, that too. Oh, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Like with film, everything, you know, requires money.
Yeah. And there's not that much to go around.
No.
Anything else you want to plug and talk about right now?
I don't know. I think we've had quite a well-rounded conversation.
We've had, yeah. Where do we find you? On social media, online and stuff?
Yeah. In what sense? Should I like list out my...
Yeah, if you want people to connect with you on Instagram or whatever.
Yeah. For my film and photography, my Instagram is eyingtheworld.
Eyingtheworld, yeah. That's your company, right?
It's my company, so eyingtheworld.com. My film production company. And then Panion is our app, so we're panion.app on Instagram and Get Panion on Facebook and getpanion.com. And we're right now available for iOS, and we're working on an Android version. I'm talking to an Android user, but we have a sign up on our website. Again, it's the same thing as like money and
and you got to start where most people use it.
And I learned that iPhone users convert at like such a higher rate than Android users in terms of the market. So if you look at how much money you can make off one iPhone user versus how much money is made off an Android user, it's so high. So that's why a lot of people start with iPhone.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. People who have Apple products are usually people with money because they're expensive as
well. And then they want to spend their money quite freely.
Yeah. They're more concerned with having the latest model and everything like that.
Yeah, perhaps.
No Twitter.
I have Twitter. What is my Twitter? I have Melanie Aronson. It's my Twitter. And Panion. Oh, it's so hard to keep track of all of your social handles. Yeah, Panion app on our Twitter. It's hard. Yeah. Do people tweet here in Sweden often?
Not as much as in
the US
and in other places of the world. I'm not sure I want to say this publicly, but I have the feeling that Twitter in some ways are on the way out. That a lot of people are starting to feel like they want to be, I mean, we as like a species, we're more visual than we are lingual or something. And I usually say that Twitter seems to be great for comedians and politicians.
And business people.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the entire startup world is very Twitter focused.
Well, things you can communicate in words are a good thing. For actors and visual artists and stuff like that, then Twitter doesn't really do much
Instagram.
For you. Yeah, then it's Insta, mostly.
Yeah, well, maybe something new will emerge.
Yeah, well, it probably is about time, I guess. All right.
Great.
Well, thanks for a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that was multifaceted and interesting. I hope you can all agree. And I'll hope you'll be back for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. And until then, smile and say hello to people you meet on the street, especially if you're Swedish. Bye.